Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
The Klamath River flows some 250 miles from southern Oregon to northern California. From its headwaters at Upper Klamath Lake, east of Medford, Oregon, the river rushes through trout habitat, forested mountains, farmland, and salmon nurseries as it makes its way to the Pacific Ocean. Rather, the river usually rushes. John Alexander of the Klamath Bird Observatory says right now, conditions are anything but normal.
Normally, when you would come out of our field station, walk down through the woods and onto the marsh, you'd be doing it in chest waders. But this year, even in the spring, when we would normally be over waist deep in water, we're walking on dry marsh bottom. And there's no water at the station where usually water persists.
Drought is desiccating almost the entire Klamath River Basin, some 12,000 to 15,000 square miles, an area approaching the size of the entirety of Massachusetts and Connecticut combined. And across those more than 9 million acres, everyone and everything is suffering. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're going to travel downstream from the Klamath headwaters to the Pacific and the cautionary tale it has for everyone about how drought may be permanently changing ways of life. We'll start today with Alex Schwartz, a reporter in the Klamath River Basin for Herald and News as part of Report for America. He joins us from Klamath Falls, Oregon. Alex, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Can you first describe a little bit about what the Klamath River Basin is like? If we were hiking in the basin or boating or fishing there, what would we see?
Sure. Well, it starts, people sort of call it an upside down river basin, sort of in the term that you have a stretch just below the headwater streams that kind of meanders over flat land. It's pretty shallow, slow, and warm. And then it gets progressively wilder as the river reaches the coast. So in other basins, you'd sort of expect water quality impacts to occur near the bottom of the watershed, not the top. So it's sort of flipped around up here. And that has some pretty serious implications for water quality in the basin and just ecosystem health in general. But you have the upper basin, which is mostly high desert, and almost all the precipitation here falls as snow in the winter. The lower basin is rugged mountains and even temperate rainforest at some points, basically Bigfoot country. And the last few miles of the river even run through the redwoods.
Yeah.
So there's many species found here that exist nowhere else on Earth. And it's some of the most remote country in the lower 48, I would say.
It's spectacularly important for all the people who live there and for the ecosystems, as you're saying, and spectacularly beautiful as well. I was reading that it contains some of the largest wetlands west of the Mississippi, too.
Yeah, so, they are called the Everglades of the West.
Yeah. So tell us, what are water conditions like everywhere in the basin?
So in the upper basin, we have a lot of issues with nutrient loading, so mostly phosphorus. And that contributes to algae outbreaks in Upper Klamath Lake, which seriously degrade the water quality of the lake. That same water eventually enters the Klamath River. There's also some reservoirs on the Klamath River that are like concentrated versions of Upper Klamath Lake that have even worse algae outbreaks and really warm up the water. And so that has consequences for the fish downstream. The common thing here this year is that there's just less water all around. And so, when you have lower water levels and lower flows, you have warmer water and more concentrations of those nutrients and all that algae.
Mm. So the impacts of that less water all around is what we're going to try and understand today, all along the length of the Klamath River. But can you let us know, Alex, usually what does that river and the basin that it drains, what does all that water make possible there?
Sure. So numerous indigenous tribes have called the basin home since time immemorial. And the thing pretty much they all have in common is fishing. So salmon were this, you know, huge life force that transported nutrients throughout the basin. But some tribes fished more local species like the Tuam and Koptu, which you'll hear more about later. But currently, there's the federally recognized tribes include the Klamath tribes of Oregon, which is actually a confederation of three ethnic groups in the upper basin, the Karuk tribe in the middle of the basin, and the Hoopa Valley and the Yurok tribes in the lower reaches of the river. Tribal members also traditionally hunt birds and game and gather plants, which also depend on water. Then you also have farmers in throughout the basin, but about half the farmland lies in the Klamath Irrigation Project, which is a federal project that was established in 1907, which traditionally took at least 300,000 acre feet of water from Upper Klamath Lake in order to water crops like alfalfa, potatoes, onions, mint. And it was pretty well known for its high quality of crops. But in recent years, drought has really damaged that.
And who's in charge of water management along the river?
So that would be the Federal Bureau of Reclamation. There's this sort of half mile stretch right at the bottom of Upper Klamath Lake where there's the main canal that diverts water to the Klamath Project. And then there's also a dam right there that regulates the level of the lake and releases water into the Klamath River. So that spot is probably the most contentious point in the entire basin. Every year, Reclamation has to adhere to requirements in biological opinions issued by other federal agencies that are trying to protect endangered species in the basin. And in years like this, where there's so little water, even those species are fighting with each other for the water.
Okay. So Alex Schwartz, hang on here for just a second, because as I mentioned, we're going to try and use this hour as a virtual trip downriver along the Klamath to really understand how the drought and the low water levels are perhaps permanently changing not just ecosystems, but ways of life. And so our first stop on the Klamath River is going to be right at the headwaters, the river's source, the Upper Klamath Lake, which, as you mentioned, is home to the Klamath tribes and several types of fish that live only there and nowhere else on planet Earth. So Dr. Alex Gagne joins us. He's a senior fish biologist for the Klamath tribes. Dr. Gagne, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna.
So can you first describe to us what Upper Klamath Lake was like, I don't know, a century or so ago?
Sure. So Upper Klamath Lake was, the Upper Klamath Basin had three large water bodies on it, Upper Klamath Lake, Lower Klamath Lake, and Tule Lake. These are the residual lakes from historic Lake Modoc that existed about 10,000 years ago. And these were a series of very interconnected shallow lakes with abundant fringe wetlands around the margins that served as juvenile fish habitat for the Tuam and Koptu.
Okay, the Tuam and Koptu. So these are, tell us what they are.
So Tuam and Koptu are a member of the catastomid fish group, or suckers, and the Tuam in the Klamath language is the Lost River sucker, and the Koptu is the short-nosed sucker, and they exist only in the Upper Klamath Basin.
Nowhere else on Earth.
Nowhere else on Earth, and they're a fairly unique fish. The Tuam is about 30 inches long at adulthood, so a very large-bodied fish. The Koptu is about 22 inches, and they would have existed in the millions, if not tens of millions, of individuals, and they acted as sort of the cleaners of the ecosystem and keeping the ecosystem in balance.
Okay, so you said they would have existed in the millions, meaning now,
yes.
How are they doing?
Now we're looking at maybe 25,000 total, about 20,000 to 24,000 Tuam, and somewhere around 3,000 Koptu. So
3,000?
3,400 or so. They're on their way out due to water quality conditions and water quantity conditions.
Does that mean that they are critically endangered?
I would say so. They haven't been designated as that officially, but we've seen a 75% plus decline in just the last 5 years of individuals. And so we're approaching the end of these species in the wild in Upper Klamath Lake.
But they have not received federal designation as being endangered.
No, they are endangered. They've been endangered since 1988.
Oh, but not critically endangered.
Not critically endangered. The last time they had young survive was about 1993, which means these are all very old adult individuals. And ever since 1993, the water quality conditions in the lake during the fall, this time of year, have effectively killed all of the young fish.
And just as a quick aside, how long do these fish live for?
The Tuam, the oldest one we found, has been about 53 years old, and the oldest Koptu, somewhere around 25.
Okay, so they're long-lived fish then.
Yes.
So Alex Schwartz a little earlier was describing a couple of the major challenges with the water in Upper Klamath Lake. We've just got about 30 seconds to go before our first break, Dr. Gagne, so I'll give you a first swing at this. What do you think, what is the biggest challenge right now that's threatening the fish?
Yeah, the biggest challenge is the phosphorus loading into Upper Klamath Lake, which fuels the algae blooms that is caused largely by unrestricted cattle grazing above the lake.
Okay, so there's phosphorus loading into the lake, and then is that being exacerbated by just the reduced volume of the lake itself?
The reduced volume of the lake and also the destruction of the fringe wetlands that are around the lake that acted as filters for the phosphorus.
Okay, so we're going to just take a quick break here and hear more about that when we come back. So Dr. Alex Gagne and Alex Schwartz as well, stand by. We're doing a virtual trip down the 250 miles of the Klamath River on the border of Oregon and California to understand better how drought, in particular, is changing ways of life there, perhaps permanently. More in a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking a virtual trip down the Klamath River to try to understand how drought and human impact are changing ways of life, perhaps making ways of life vanish along the entirety of the 12 to 15 thousand square miles of the Klamath River Basin. It's a cautionary tale for all of us. And I'm joined today by Alex Schwartz, reporter for Herald and News as part of Report for America. He's with us from Klamath Falls, Oregon. Dr. Alex Gagne is with us as well from Chiloquin, Oregon. He's a senior fish biologist for the Klamath tribes. We'll be hearing from farmers and other tribal members a little later this hour as we continue our journey downriver. But Dr. Gagne, describe to us a little bit how you think decisions on how to manage the fish have downstream impacts on the Klamath.
Sure. So we're in a very difficult position. We have an environment that no longer produces the amount of water that it did in the early 1900s. The project was developed in the early 1900s. Yet we have more demands on the system. So when the project was first developed, there was nothing such as the ESA, and there was very little concern for the rights and the values of indigenous peoples. So we have a system where the agricultural community is demanding water that isn't there and that has been allocated to different social values, meaning protecting endangered species and also fulfilling the inherent sovereignty of indigenous peoples. We also have layered on that climate change and now drought conditions. So everybody is stuck in a very difficult position. We really have no control over how much water nature produces. However, we do have control over how it is distributed in amongst all the various users. Okay. And that's really the crux of the problem here.
Right. So that was going to be my final question for you. There's something that we must underscore. Can't make it rain anymore or make it snow anymore at the moment. Only Mother Nature is in control of that, even if we put a hard stop to how much carbon we're putting in the atmosphere today. But given the tools that we do have, that the region does have at its disposal, is there a way to balance all the needs of the people and the species that live in the basin?
Sure, I believe there is. The one other thing we can't control is the needs of these species. The fish need whatever water they require to complete their life cycle and to continue existing. We have no control over that. So the first primary concern should be the needs of the species that we are affecting. We've also had agriculture on this planet for around 14,000 years, and we've been able to adapt technologically, behaviorally, and through crop science methods to use less water. That means efficient irrigation systems, alternative crops that are more adapted to arid conditions and arid environments. And so we feel that it's the obligation of people to adapt to the changing conditions of the environment and not require that three species of fish face extinction to grow crops. Mm.
Well, Dr. Alex Gagne, senior fish biologist for the Klamath tribes, joining us today from Chiloquin, Oregon. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We're going to hear from a farmer in just a moment. But Alex Schwartz, let me turn back to you because I'd love a little bit more context here. This isn't the first time there's been a severe drought in the region, right? In the early 2000s, there was one as well that led to some key incidents and decisions thereafter. Can you talk about that?
Sure. So for the first, I guess, roughly a century of the project's existence, they were basically able to take as much water as they needed from Upper Klamath Lake to water their crops. So they would actually, you know, more water would leave the lake during drought years. And so after sort of, you know, almost 100 years of that, you really saw these declines in the fish species, you know, which were also related to those land use changes, as Dr. Gagne mentioned. And then during a really severe drought in 2001, these biological opinions from these federal agencies sort of kicked in for the first time and required reclamation to maintain the water level of Upper Klamath Lake for the Tuam and Koptu, along with higher flows in the Klamath River for salmon. And that meant that barely any water was left over for the farmers in the Klamath Project, and they protested in response to their irrigation water being cut off.
Okay, so it was cut off then, basically, in the early 2000s.
Yeah, it was not as severe as this year. Nothing, they've never really experienced anything like has happened this summer. But they I think the irrigation was cut off sometime in the summer, and then you saw some protests at the canal head gates.
Okay.
And there were some, there were a couple times where they were actually able to force open the canal head gates and release a little bit of water.
And what happened this summer is the complete shut off of those canal gates?
Yeah. So in the spring, Reclamation announced that the canal just wouldn't open at all this year. And that's never happened before. And, you know, the that was a huge blow to farmers in the project. And it was driven by the lowest, some of the lowest inflows ever to Upper Klamath Lake from some of those tributaries. There just wasn't enough water for the Bureau to meet ESA requirements, not only for lake levels in the spring, let alone the flows for salmon. And so the farmers were sort of last in line and didn't get a drop of water.
So just to, again, to reiterate, farmers at one time were able to rely on millions of gallons of water, and this summer that got reduced to zero.
Correct.
But what about the Klamath River, the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement, right? That's from, what, about a little over a decade ago? There was, they're supposed to, as my rudimentary understanding is, they're supposed to be equal, they're supposed to be sharing of the water all along the basin.
Yeah, you're right. Well, that, I mean, that's what sort of everybody's just kind of kicking themselves, wishing that this agreement had actually taken effect. So this was started negotiations pretty much right after 2001. People were like, okay, this can never happen again. So they, you know, tribes, environmental groups, agricultural groups came to the table and spent years and years, countless hours, designing this massive restoration agreement that not only, you know, came up with a system to give the farmers a slightly more reliable supply of water so that they would always expect to get something even during the driest years, but that would just have to fluctuate. The Klamath tribes were willing to give up some of the water in Upper Klamath Lake in certain year types. And then the same with the downriver tribes. But it also included hundreds of millions of dollars for really large-scale ecosystem restoration. So like restoring wetland habitat, reducing phosphorus loading into Upper Klamath Lake, removing dams throughout the basin. That would have all made the species a lot more resilient and able to handle these droughts like they would have in, you know, prior to colonization. The problem was the KBRA never went through Congress. Our local political representatives just weren't able to introduce it or get it passed. And it sort of failed at the end of 2015.
So a plan that might have helped everyone died in Congress.
Correct.
Okay. Alex, hang on here, because I want to travel about 50 miles south from where we began this show at the Upper Klamath Lake in Oregon. And let's go downriver to Tule Lake in California, where Scott Soyes farms horseradish, onion, garlic, peppermint, spearmint, alfalfa, and cereal grains. Scott is owner of Soyes Family Farms, and he joins us now. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
Can you describe to us what the soil's like on your farm right now?
Yeah, that's probably the easiest thing to answer out of everything we could talk about here. The soil on my farm is some of the richest soil that you could find. It's a dream for an agriculturist. I'm living on what was an ancient lake bed, 6 million years of duck manure and tules that fills a crater that is part of a volcanic system here, part of the Cascade Range. And because of that, this is when Bureau of Reclamation took the water off and created homesteads here, they moved that water in above us into Upper Klamath Lake and held it in Clear Lake to the east of us. And those are the reservoirs now that feed the Klamath River. So that's a simple question. This is phenomenal soil, and it produces some of the best crops of potatoes and mint and spearmint. It's a much desired area for agriculturists.
But you need the water.
You need the water. The project was designed to have water. The deed that my grandfather, who was a World War II homesteader, he put his name in a pickle jar in 1946, was drawn, came out, picked a pin out and put it on the map and came and found his 72 acres of paradise and developed a farm here, of which I'm the third generation. But that deed included a right to water in it that's been of much contention in the last 35, 40 years.
Well, Alex was describing to us a little earlier about how the water got shut off this summer. Can you tell, first of all, what's your impression of what happened, Scott, and how did that have an impact on your farm?
I think this all starts years before us. It starts in 1973 with the Endangered Species Act, a well-intended act that has become the law of the land if you're in the West. And we're living that. We're the poster child for it. In 2001, we faced two biological opinions, one for the sucker fish in Upper Klamath Lake and one for the salmon in the Klamath River. And they were conflicting biological opinions that demanded more water than could ever be in the system. That year we got a small amount of surface water that came down through the project and it didn't do a lot of good. It was early enough call in the season to not irrigate a lot of crops. And so a lot of people didn't try that year. This is our second year in a row of being curtailed severely. We came out of the winter of 2018 and 19 with a lot of water in the system, flood stage situations up and down the river. We had fields that we couldn't plant because it was so wet here. So we live through cyclical droughts. The difference of what is happening to us now is regulation for single species management is dictating what happens with that water to the point where it's not making room for the federal wildlife refuges that are here in the basin with us or the farmers. And we're living that firsthand and see the flaws in what should be ecosystem management.
Aha. Uh-huh. So can you tell me then, let's focus on this year for a second. I hear you about the broader context, but I also want to understand sort of in as much detail as possible, how is the water shutoff having an impact on you this year, Scott?
Well, it's a severe impact to our basin. We are utilizing our groundwater resources. Since 1992, people have been having to drill wells. That was the last severe drought that we went through. 2001 was not anywhere near the drought that we had in 1992, naturally created droughts. And so there's a groundwater resource that's being used here this year that's keeping some acres green, but not in full production. We're deficit irrigating crops to the extent that we aren't getting yields. We're trying to maintain stands of alfalfa and other perennial crops that we don't want to lose the investment of. And people are getting some return out of that. But this will be a deficit year for the economy of the Klamath Basin.
Mm. Do you worry that there could be some really negative long-term impacts here? And I ask because we've done a lot of shows about how this current drought cycle that the entire of Western United States is in may go on for a long, long time. You know, this water shutoff that you're experiencing this summer could become more regular, perhaps, in the future. I mean, let's just game this out. If it does continue on this way, how much longer do you think you could keep farming there?
Well, I think the question becomes how long do the fish survive, period. We're releasing water out of Upper Klamath Lake that is extremely warm water that is diluting the natural accretions that come into the Klamath River and keep cool water for the fish, the salmon in the river. And so climate change, if that's the argument, is will change a lot of things. We're not the only ones that'll suffer in that. And I don't it doesn't just because you have a fish doesn't mean more water is always the answer for that water. It's about the right conditions in the right place. And we certainly subscribe to that, as Alex talked about the KBRA. That was a big part of that was fix the fish and fix the farms. You can have salmon and potatoes on the same plate, but it's about balance. It's about the ecosystem. It's about what's right for it, and not necessarily an absolute disaster. That the national wildlife refuges that we have here in Tule Lake and Lower Klamath National Wildlife Refuge have received zero water until of recent, where we tried to avoid a botulism kill on the Tule Lake National Wildlife Refuge by bringing 10,000 acre feet of water into that refuge. That should have been celebrated by people everywhere as a successful thing. And unfortunately, this is such a political hotbed here.
Uh-huh.
And there's so many misunderstood at all issues that go along with all of this. We're not just dealing with a changing climate, per se. We're also dealing with a changing climate of the people that are at the table and the people that understand the true needs of the system.
Okay. I want to talk to you about that, but we have to take a break here in just about 30 seconds or so. So I'm going to ask you to hang on here for a second, Mr. Sois and Alex Schwartz as well, because we are trying to get an understanding about how water and really the lack of it and how it's being managed as well along the entirety of the Klamath River Basin is changing ways of life there and what lessons we can all draw from it. So we'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're taking a virtual trip down the Klamath River along the border of Oregon and California to understand how drought an ongoing concern over how water is apportioned along 10 to 15,000 square miles is impacting and perhaps permanently changing ways of life. And I'm joined today by Alex Schwartz. He's a reporter for Herald and News as part of Report for America. He's with us from Klamath Falls, Oregon. And right now we're focusing on Tule Lake in California, where Scott Sois joins us. He's a third generation farmer and owner of Sois Family Farms. And just before the break, Scott, you were telling us how not only is the physical climate changing, but I believe, to paraphrase what you were saying, that the climate of the people is also changing. Were you referring to the fact that over the course of the summer, there was concern that there might even be something like a violent water rebellion when the water got shut off for the farmers?
No, you know, I don't think there was ever going to be a violent water rebellion. you know, the thing about farmers is that we're Americans, always in our heart, and we wear that on our sleeve. And a great example of that is in 2001. In 2001, there was a standoff at the headgates where farmers rallied and set up an encampment there and protested peacefully. And granted, there, you know, there's things that they do to try to bring attention, and you know, sometimes that means that you have to wave your hands a little harder or have people convinced that something's going to happen just to try to get the attention of people that might not care that you're there, and make it interesting for them. And I think that's a lot of what you saw. But just as in 2001, when 9/11 happened, you know, there were federal marshals at the head gates that year, most of the summer. And as soon as 9/11 happened, the farmers took everything down and went home. And I don't believe that there would ever be a violent standoff. I believe that what we had at the Klamath head gates that was probably the riskiest of all the situation was people from outside of the area that came and tried to be supportive of farmers. But more than that, they were there on the principle of private property rights and this dismantling of rural America, which, you know, we've become a poster child for that here in the West, and especially here, we're the tip of the spear here in the Klamath Basin. And so I think that that's more what you're referring to. And that all, you know, sadly, that a lot of that went away early this summer. People were gathered there and trying to make a point, and the real farmers that were there just they kind of lost heart in it. I mean, when you're watching fields dry up and having a hard time telling your story, people go away and with their head hung, and that's not a healthy discussion either.
Yeah. Well, Alex Schwartz, let me turn back to you here, because I'd love just a minute or two of more detail about why there was some concern about what might happen around the irrigation canal, right? Because I believe that there was worry for some time that Ammon Bundy was going to come to town, and perhaps, I mean, he's quite a infamous right-wing extremist now, and was maybe going to lead some kind of standoff.
Yeah. So after the project's, I guess, non-allocation was announced in the spring, two irrigators who do own some acreage in the Klamath Project, but very small compared to, I guess, I would say the average farmer in the project. They purchased land directly next to the A Canal head gates, which that's the main canal that diverts water from Upper Klamath Lake. They set up a big red and white tent there. They called it the Water Crisis Info Center, and they began hosting meetings there that were staffed by the local chapter of People's Rights Oregon, which is a far right group that was started by Ammon Bundy last summer. So they, you know, these two irrigators told reporters that they were planning to force open the head gates, similarly to what happened during 2001. And they mentioned at some points that Bundy himself was prepared to, you know, provide any assistance. So there was concern that, you know, Bundy himself was headed to Klamath Falls, and you definitely saw some worry, you know, among all communities in the basin. Because as Scott said, you know, the concern is not necessarily like people locally protesting. The concern was, you know, outside actors coming in and trying to make the Klamath their soapbox.
Yeah, I understand that a farmer named Ben Duval, who's the president of the Klamath Water Users Association, was writing to members and condemning people that were being recruited from other parts of the country, right, to come in and participate in these demonstrations. So fortunately, nothing terrible happened. But Scott, if I can turn back to you, I have one more question for you. It's the same question I'm trying to ask everyone this hour. Do you think that there's a solution here, a way to balance the needs of all of the farmers, the fish, the native tribes, everybody who relies on the lakes and rivers in the basin? And what is that solution?
Well, I do think that it was the KBRA. I think it is the KBRA. I think it's a matter of, you know, the reason why things weren't enacted in 2015 and that KBRA died was largely the support for KBRA waned because of dam removal. It was such a hot topic locally, politically, from here all the way to DC. It was just kind of a nails on the chalkboard for some people. It was a spear in the side for others. And And the idea of dam removal is utopia for the tribes that believe that a free-flowing river is ultimately what's needed. And as an irrigator, I didn't have a dog in that fight. The dams that are below us don't control my irrigation water. I believe that the property owners along the river, that the four dams that are in question that have a lake that has property value attached to that for people that have built houses there, that needed to be dealt with. And they were trying to do that. But it was such a radical idea. Dam removal is going forward. That the anticipation is that dams start coming out in 2023. The part of that agreement that didn't go through was the component that took care of the National Wildlife Refuges, which would have had 100,000 acre feet of water guaranteed to them, which this year are only receiving the 10,000 acre feet that's being brought down through Tule Lake Irrigation District and delivered into Sump 1B to support 127 suckers that are entrapped there and 100,000 birds that were going through molting that could have had botulism kill. That's the only surface water coming into this side of the project. Yeah. And so it's pretty critical that we get back to that, because it dealt with agriculture, it dealt with tribal interests, and what was good then is still the same approach now in my mind.
Well, Scott Soyce, third generation farmer and owner of Soyce Family Farms in Tule Lake, California, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Last stop on our virtual trip downriver on the Klamath is at the mouth of the Klamath River near the Pacific Ocean, an area shared by the Yurok people and Redwood National Park. Barry McCovey Jr. Joins us from Klamath, California, where he's senior fisheries biologist with the Yurok Tribal Fisheries Program and a Yurok Tribal member as well. Barry McCovey Jr., welcome to On Point.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So tell me a little bit about the salmon there. How healthy or not healthy is the population there?
Yeah, so salmon runs here on the Klamath have been in steady decline for many, many decades. And it's gotten extremely bad over the last few years. Since around 2014 and 2015, we experienced drought. We've kind of been in this perpetual state of drought since then. And we've seen population declines that we've never seen before. And it's to a point where there's no longer enough fish to harvest for the tribe to feed its people. So things are getting pretty bad.
No, not enough to feed the people. And so how much of this is due to what you heard prior to you in this hour, and the water management decisions being made upriver and even all the way up at Upper Klamath Lake?
It's really a huge part of the declines in fish species in the Klamath River. There are many, many aspects of decline, from, you know, habitat loss to water management issues to disease to sedimentation, dams blocking 400 miles of historic spawning habitat. There are a lot of reasons why salmon numbers have declined over the decades. Mm-hmm. This year in particular, we were hit extremely hard by the drought, like everyone was in the basin.
And do you worry that the drought, since it seems like it may go on for some time, is just going to continue to make everything worse?
Sure. There's not enough water to go around in this basin. And like Dr. Gagne said, there's not enough water for fish. And we can't dictate how much water fish need. They need a certain amount of water, and there's not enough to go around. And so something needs to change. And we do foresee drought continuing, but we're working really hard to build climate resiliency into the basin.
Can you talk to me a little bit more about that?
Sure. So like Scott mentioned, you know, dam removal is a huge part of that. Dam removal will be the largest river restoration project maybe in the history of America. And so what we're doing is we're removing four dams on the Klamath. We're opening up 400 miles of historic spawning habitat. That will help to build in climate resiliency. That will give the river access to springs and many other habitats that haven't been accessible for over 100 years now. That in itself is huge, and it's a major move in the right direction as far as restoring salmon here on the Klamath River and other species. Look, it's not just salmon that we're concerned about. There's lamprey, there's green sturgeon, there's steelhead. There's many, many species that are connected to this ecosystem, and dam removal is going to help all of them, and it's going to help all of the people in the basin also. And you know, our job here at the Yurok Tribe is to try and restore balance to this basin, and we feel like dam removal, landscape scale restoration projects like that are the path forward.
Well, Barry McCovey Jr., Senior Fisheries Biologist with the Yurok Tribal Fisheries Program, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Alex Schwartz, I've got about 30 seconds left with you. In your reporting, have you found that people along the entirety of the basin are genuinely concerned about their ways of life vanishing forever unless some kind of workable solution is found?
I would definitely say yes. Especially with the Chuaman Koptu, a species that's literally hurtling toward extinction, there is a lot of concern that these, you know, traditional lifeways for indigenous peoples are in jeopardy. And, you know, also the farmers who definitely have a shorter history here, but, you know, have been here for, you know, some generations and are seeing their, you know, their lifeways decline.
Hmm. Seems like there can be a set of solutions, though, if they don't keep dying in Congress. But Alex Schwartz, reporter for Herald and News as part of Report for America, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as you've heard, for many in the Klamath River Basin, there are more questions about the future than answers. And so we want to wrap up today with another group that can't seem to win in this complicated situation. That's birds, such as thrushes, hummingbirds, and flycatchers. The diversion of water from refuges in the Klamath River Basin and climate change is altering migratory patterns of bird species on the Pacific Flyway from Alaska to Patagonia. John Alexander is executive director of the Klamath Bird Observatory, and the observatory's monitoring station is at the Klamath River headwaters, where we began today's episode, on the shore of Upper Klamath Lake.
Normally, when you would come out of our field station, walk down through the woods and onto the marsh, you'd be doing it in chest waders. But this year, even in the spring, when we would normally be over waist deep in water, we're walking on dry marsh bottom. And there's no water at the station where usually water persists. The Klamath Refuge system is a linchpin for fall migratory birds. Western populations of waterfowl and other species of migratory birds depend on this very small area in this critical part of their journey, the fall migration. The decisions that we're making now in the basin are putting at risk the birds that make their remarkable annual migrations through this area. And this is a clear signal that the arteries of the West's, our wetland ecosystems, are failing. What can we maintain with regards to an agro-farming industry in the Upper Klamath Basin while also maintaining the headwaters of one of our continent's most important watersheds, a watershed that fueled cultures and fed cultures? And how do we balance those needs? What's the economic impacts of giving the refuges more water? You know, there's always families and livelihoods that are important and that we need to be concerned about. And we need to balance them with what we need as a broader society. If we lose some of those crops in the Upper Klamath Basin, is it going to have an impact on our food resources in the West? Or is the impact going to be economic in nature to the families that make their persistence and they're important, they're a part of our community? And is there any way we can compensate for that? Can we afford to compensate for that? On the other hand, if we're going to decide not to give the refuges the water, and there's going to be a cost to the salmon, there's going to be a cost to the other resources that the river provides to all of us, including the First Nations, can we repay that? So we need to think about what are the ancient cultures and what are important to them? What are the current modern cultures and what are important to them? And what can we afford to change? And what can we afford to piece back into a system that functions for the world and functions for the ecosystems that sustain us all way into the future.
John Alexander, Executive Director of the Klamath Bird Observatory. So that's the key question. How is drought changing the way of life where you live? Is it permanently changing ways of life? Are there innovative solutions near you that you'd like to learn more about? Send us an email at onpoint@wbur.org or call us at 617-353-0683. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.